If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, and welcome to Life of the Week, where leading historians delve into the lives of some of history's most intriguing and significant figures. From ancient Egyptian pharaohs and medieval warriors to daring 20th century spies.
In the list of famous explorers, the name of Christopher Columbus stands out. Seen for many years as the man who supposedly discovered the Americas, his heroic legacy is now being challenged and critiqued. Speaking to Paul Bloomfield, historian Julia McClure considers the exploits, achievements, and failings of the explorer and navigator. From paving the way for European exploration of the New World to poor treatment of America's indigenous inhabitants.
Today we're exploring the life of Christopher Columbus. And I'm delighted to be joined by Julia McClure, Senior Lecturer in Late Medieval and Early Modern Global History at the University of Glasgow. Julia's work examines the impacts of colonialism on Indigenous societies. She's the ideal expert to discuss the life, actions and legacy of the navigator created by Europeans with discovering, in inverted commas, the Americas. Julia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So can we start with what is ostensibly at least the easiest question? Who was Christopher Columbus?
Well, first of all, you may have seen the name Christopher Columbus written in a number of different ways. So it's known in Italian as Cristoforo Colombo, in Spanish as Cristobal Colón, and in Genoese as Cristoforo Combo. And he's best known to us in English as Christopher Columbus. So Christopher Columbus was a Genoese navigator who's best known for convincing the Spanish monarchs, Ferdinand II of Aragon and Isabel I of Castile, to fund his expedition across the Atlantic to find a westerly ocean route to the spice markets in the East Indies. And he conducted this voyage in 1492. He was the first European to make contact with the Taino Lucano people in the Caribbean island that's known to them as Guarani and is known to us today as the Bahamas. So that's him.
Well, let's go right back to the beginning. Where and when was the man we know as Christopher Columbus born?
Like many people born in the medieval and early modern periods, the exact date of his birth is unknown, but it's thought to be sometime between August and October in 1451. He was born in the Republic of Genoa, which is a place on the Mediterranean coast that we would know today as part of Italy. And we often associate the opening of European colonialism in the Americas with the Atlantic powers, Spain, Portugal, and later Britain and France. But places like Genoa were an important centre for commerce and banking, and help supply skills and capital for colonial ventures.
So this man born in what was then an important centre for navigation, can you tell us a little about his early life and how his career developed?
Well, he got off to a rather rocky start. We know quite a bit about his early life. He was from a Genoese family of wool merchants, and it's thought that he followed a quite typical trajectory of a Genoese merchant, looking to increase his income and reputation through a maritime career after his family business had suffered financial losses. He worked for a number of Genoese families who were prominent in international commerce. It's thought that he was shipwrecked off the coast of the Gibraltar Straits sometime around 1477. And at this point, he arrived in Lisbon penniless. And he based himself in Lisbon between 1477 and 1485. And it's during this time that he married a Portuguese noblewoman. His fortunes at that point were somewhat on the up. They had a son, Diego, but unfortunately his wife died. He later partnered with another woman, Beatriz de Arana, who he did not marry, but he had another son known as Fernando, who was born in 1488. So it's during this time when he was based in Lisbon that he started to extend his voyages further. He travelled to the near Atlantic island of Madeira, where the Portuguese had already developed a number of sugar plantations. He also followed the Portuguese shipping routes further south and reaching as far south as the port of modern-day Ghana. According to his own reports, which were written much later, he also travelled as far north in the Atlantic as Iceland. So these travels would have given him a practical apprenticeship in navigation science, but they would also have made him aware of the other types of maritime knowledge available, the stories told on board ships of land sightings and possibilities of land to the further west. From a young age, Columbus had an avaricious appetite for knowledge of the world. So it was not only this kind of practical experience that he was getting on board the ships, but he was also a self-taught man, teaching himself about astronomy, cartography and cosmology, which is the study of heaven and earth. And he immersed himself in classical and contemporary texts, reading anything he'd get his hands on about to acquire this knowledge of the world. He was interested in particular in Aristotle, Plato and Pliny, and especially interested in Ptolemy's Mappa Mundi, which is a world map produced in the second century. And he also read the stories of another Italian traveller, Marco Polo, who travelled to the Far East in the 13th century. He was especially interested in the work of a near contemporary of his, Pierre d'Ailly, who'd written the book The Image of the World or the Imago Mundi in 1410, making no less than 898 notes in its margins. And significantly, he was also interested in the works by medieval Muslim scholars, notably the writings of Al-Fagani, who had studied in the cosmopolitan intellectual centre of Baghdad in the 9th century. And it's the work of Al-Fagani which would prove essential when he later built his case to travel west. So because of all these different interests, not only kind of travelling on the seas, but also immersing himself in these texts, he's known as a Renaissance man. And I think this is true if we consider the Renaissance as a kind of global intellectual movement that was built on knowledge and ideas received from many different parts of the world at that time.
Okay, so by the end of the 1480s, his head was obviously full of knowledge and ideas about the wider world and what was out there. How did he come to make his first transatlantic expedition? What sparked the idea and what did he think it could achieve?
So as I just said, he's voraciously reading various compendiums of geographical and cosmological knowledge, and was convinced himself of the finding a westerly route to the luxury markets in the East Indies. So it's commonly and wrongly thought that prior to Columbus, people had not tried to sail west across the Atlantic because they thought the world was flat and would fall off the edge. And this is, as we know, not true. What people debated in the Middle Ages was the scale of the globe. And people thought the Earth was bigger than it was, and therefore it was more convenient to trade luxury goods from the Indian Ocean world through Islamic merchants via land routes. Or if there was going to be a sea route, it was thought the most viable option would be to sail south and circumnavigate the coast of Africa. So Columbus based his proposal that it was feasible to sail west to reach the east on his argument that the world was smaller than had earlier been thought. And this calculation was based on the circumference of the earth of the work of the Muslim scholar Al-Fagani. And it was importantly wrong. It was an underestimation of the size of the earth. He underestimated the size of the sea between the Canary Islands and Japan by about 8,200 miles. He hadn't realised that Al-Fagani had made a calculation using Arabic miles and not Roman isles. And he also didn't know about the landmass of the Americas. So he had other things that made him convinced that the landmass between Europe and Asia was shorter. So the Venetian traveller Marco Polo had reported when he travelled to Cathay, which is the word that the medieval Europeans used to describe China, that there was a series of islands off the coast, one of which was called Sipangu, which is thought to be Japan. And significantly also, he received a letter from another Italian. So there's lots of Italians involved in this story, a Florence-born cosmographer, Paolo Toscanelli. And Toscanelli had himself produced a map as well, also miscalculating the size of Asia by about 5,000 miles and depicting a series of further islands off the coast of Sipangu. And so it was this kind of compendium of knowledge and this miscalculation of the size of the Earth that made him convinced that the journey west would be feasible. So it wasn't an easy journey to get this proposal taken up. It was a difficult effort to get his ideas believed. So in 1484, he first petitioned King João, or John II of Portugal, which was the country where he was living at the time. And the Portuguese were not interested, and this is not surprising, because they were heavily invested in opening the sea route to the south and had funded expeditions around the coast of Africa. And one of these had just come back when, at the time that Columbus was making this petition, Portuguese navigator Diego Cao had returned and reported to the Portuguese monarchy that this sea route to the south was going to be possible. So instead, he took his proposal to the Portuguese competitor, which was Spain. And Spain initially was also sceptical, but in 1486, the Portuguese were successful in circumnavigating the Cape of Good Hope. This was by Bartolomé Dias, and this really put the pressure on the Spanish monarchy to find their own ocean route. So at this point, they decided to back Columbus. This was in 1486. Now, a number of years passed between that and when we know that the voyage took place in 1492. And again, like in Portugal, advisors to the monarchy were sceptical of the calculation of the Earth and other logistical aspects. And so he stayed in Spain and built his case. And what's also significant about his time in Spain is that he stayed in the Franciscan convent of La Rábida, which is on the Andalusian coast. And as part of a lifelong connection with the Franciscan order, and this stay in the Franciscan convent has led to many legends concerning what knowledge the Franciscans had given him before he travelled west across the Atlantic. What is known is he certainly used their library and built his case to fortify the proposal to sail west. So you asked me what was his motivation. And I think that any historians who've tried to delve into the mental world of Christopher Columbus and tried to understand this would probably only agree on one thing, which is his intensity. I think we can kind of summarise his motivations in three branches, as it were. So first, he'd grown up in this bustling and competitive commercial town of Genoa, and he's likely a business-minded person interested in increasing profits and reputation. So I mentioned that Genoese family's financial losses at the start of his career, arriving penniless in Lisbon, and being a self-taught man as well. So in 1492, the Spanish monarch set the terms for Columbus's voyage in the Capitulations of Santa Fe, which promised him the rank of Admiral of the Ocean Sea and 10% of profits from any new lands in perpetuity. So these competitive terms demonstrate his ambition for reputation and profit. So second, he was a somewhat esoteric and eclectic scholar whose breadth and depth of research convinced him that the aquatic gap was narrower than was previously thought. And he was really desperate to prove his geographical theory correct. As a self-taught scholar who had not been born into the nobility, he really wanted to be taken seriously by his contemporaries. And the third issue of motivation was that he was intensely religious. This is evidenced by the fact that he spent his time in Spain as a resident of the Franciscan convent. And when he departed on his first voyage, indeed, he left his son, Diego, with these Franciscans. And when he died, he was buried in a Franciscan habit. But it's likely that these religious motivations increased over time, shaped by his hazy understanding of the scale of the voyage. Columbus himself later compared himself on his first voyage to Moses, in fact. And this kind of prophetic significance is not surprising if we think about the other things taking place in 1492. So this is the year not only when Columbus crosses the Atlantic, but when the Catholic monarchs of Spain defeated the last Muslim Taifa state of Granada, and it also tragically expelled its Jewish populations from the peninsula. And so Columbus is really seeing his crossing of the Atlantic amidst the backdrop of these broader geopolitical shifts. And so it's not surprising that he takes on the later interpretation that he does and sort of seeing this as a continuation of the Crusades and seeing the wealth gained in the Americas as designated for the Holy Lands.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
So we've got to the stage, this pivotal year, 1492. He's persuaded the Spanish monarchy to back him. He's persuaded various people that his ideas are correct and that a sea route to the east is possible. Can you briefly describe his first transatlantic voyage?
The first voyage consisted of a convoy of three caravels or ships, the Santa Maria, the Pinta and the Niña. And you can actually see replicas of these ships if you visit the Andalusian port town of Sanlúcar de Barrameda. If you go and see these ships, what's really striking is just how small and unstable they look in comparison with the might of the Atlantic Ocean. I certainly wouldn't want to fancy crossing the Atlantic on one of these vessels. So Columbus was wrong, as I said, about the circumference of the Earth and this distance between the two land points. But he was able to take advantage of the trade winds. And this is significant because it means that then his journey between Palos de la Frontera, where he sets off from, and where he lands in the Caribbean, takes just 5 weeks. And this is kind of definitely aided by these trade winds. And the use of the wind patterns becomes the characteristic point of the so-called age of sails. This is between the 16th century and the 19th century. And so he goes from Palos de la Frontera, repositions the ships in the Canary Islands, which at this point are already under control of the Spanish, and then sets off for this, what becomes a 5 week journey. He lands first in the indigenous Lucayan Taino territory, known to them as Guanani, as I mentioned before. And significantly, he takes possession of it in the name of the Spanish monarchs. And this initiates the process of the European colonization of the Americas that would change the lives of those indigenous people and their ecosystems forever. So one of the reasons it took Columbus so long to realize his transatlantic voyage was the scale of the financial and logistical challenge. So the crown investment in Columbus's voyage increased the pressure to find sources of economic wealth and yield financial returns. And you can see this when you read his logbooks, that he's really desperate to find a source of income. And every time he spots silver or gold jewellery, he's desperately looking for signs of, you know, where it might be from. And he's, in fact, capturing indigenous people in order to force them into showing them that where the mines are. And whenever they're kind of indicating anything, because, of course, there would be this language gap, he interprets this as them showing him where the mines are. And this taking of captives becomes one of the definitive features of the Columbus voyage and sets a really kind of dark precedent for what unfolds, as we know, in the larger story of colonialism. So he first captures a number of Arawak people and, as I say, tries to force them into showing the Europeans the source of this gold. So the rest of the voyage was filled with adversities and challenges. The three ships separate. At one point, one runs aground. And Columbus left 39 men on the island they come to name Hispaniola. And they established the first, what can be thought of as the first colony. They call it La Navidad, or the Nativity, to Christmas, because the ship has run aground there on Christmas Day. And the first colony, in fact, is built from the wreckage of this ship. And again, I think that kind of helps us to, you know, reflect on these stories of European conquest and how they've been told as kind of Europeans triumphing against the odds. And here are this kind of 39 men being left there with the remains of a shipwreck and this structure being built with the help of, in this case, the indigenous people as well. The ships separate again on the way back to Spain and they hit a storm. And at this point, Columbus then makes first landing, not in Spain where he should have been going, but actually in Lisbon. And this leads to early accusations of treachery. But nevertheless, 1 week later, when he finally gets to Spain, he is received there as a hero. And he returns there with a number of indigenous people who he'd captured, these Arawak people from the island of Hispaniola. And about six or seven of those who had survived the journey were presented to the Spanish monarchs alongside other, inverted commas, curiosities. And so indigenous people really were presented in this way, presented alongside pearls, small gold objects and other craft works and other types of exotica, including parrots. And I think that this presentation, this mode of presentation is significant because it begins that long struggle over the status and rights of indigenous peoples.
So he's returned from his first voyage with peoples, with treasures, if you like. What happens next? How does he go about preparing for future voyages? What were the purposes and what did they achieve?
So Columbus led three more voyages across the Atlantic, each with different trajectories, motivations and outcomes. The second voyage lasted from 1493 to 1496. At this point, he returns to that site of La Navidad with over 1,000 men, which must have been really stunning for the local inhabitants who, you know, first helped these people set up, you know, from a shipwreck, this settlement. But what he finds when he goes back to that settlement is that it's broken down. There's been infighting amongst the Spanish settlers. There's been fighting with the local inhabitants and any survivors are certainly not in a good state. Columbus then establishes another short-lived outpost and he continues on his quest to reach Asia, which is still his kind of primary objective. He's still kind of, you know, trying to convince the Spanish monarchs that this voyage is viable, it's important because it's going to make this sea route to Asia possible. So he then sails along the coast of Cuba and his descriptions are kind of very clear that he's convinced that he's going to eventually reach China by doing so. He thinks that he's in Asia and he dies protesting still that he had visited Asia despite his four voyages to the Americas. So as the leader of the Spanish colonial enterprise, he also set a really ruthless example. It's known from various reports that he was ruthless with indigenous people, beating them to try to find information about the source of precious metals. He also introduced the encomienda labor tribute system that for the people who experienced it was really scarcely different to slavery. The source of gold and silver were not forthcoming and he's kind of feeling quite desperate about making financial returns on this voyage for the Spanish monarchy. And he enslaves some indigenous Taino people, sending around 500 people back to Spain in the year 1495. And some of these people were sent not only to show that this could be a form of economic capital, but also as punishment for their role in resistance. So you have acts of resistance with the indigenous people taking place quite actively at this time, which is unsurprising given the behaviour of these Europeans who'd, you know, not just come to trade, but were behaving in this quite ruthless way, as I say. Columbus sends enslaved indigenous people to Spain, but the Spanish monarchs are considering what to do with this question. And in 1500, they actually say that the indigenous people who've been sent from the Caribbean islands and put up for sale as slaves should be freed and returned to their country of origin. Queen Isabella famously says, "These people are my subjects." That's significant because it's an act of emancipation, but it's also showing political hegemony over these people. So it's an act of colonization also. And this, it doesn't end the enslavement of indigenous peoples, but it does shape the way that this institution of slavery will play out. So the second voyage, he doesn't stop there. He carries on and has another voyage between 1498 and 1500. And it's at this point, on the third voyage, that he first reaches the mainland of South America on what's now the northern coast of Venezuela. of course, he also still didn't know that that's where he was and is still protesting that he's in islands off the coast of Japan. And Columbus continues to have problems establishing colonial rule. And I should note that at this point that he's not only ruthless with indigenous people, but also with his fellow Spaniards. And he is kind of ruthless in the punishment of them as well. And he has one so-called rebel hanged. So he's not winning himself any friends amongst his Spanish colleagues or the indigenous people of the Caribbean at this time. So he's faced with all this unrest and he appeals to Spain for help. But by this time, reports of Columbus's own activity has already reached the Spanish monarchs. And so while he's out there on his third voyage, Spain sent the Spanish nobleman, Francisco de Bobadilla, to investigate reports of Columbus's tyrannical rule. So Bobadilla arrived in Hispaniola and was straight away met with repeated denunciations of Columbus's cruelty and the cruelty of not only Columbus, but also his brother, who's out there on the voyage with him. So he seizes Columbus's property and declares himself the governor. So at this point, Columbus's situation is not looking good. And in fact, his third voyage ends by being sent back to Spain in chains. This is happening in 1500. And he's received into a jail when he gets back to Spain. This fall from grace was short-lived, and the monarchs eventually, after a few weeks, release Columbus and call for the restitution of his property. But at this point, this challenge has been significant, and his rights to that colonial revenue that had been originally granted had been significantly challenged. And so the fourth voyage is all about trying to reclaim that power, those titles, those rights, and also to kind of carry on with the expedition of trying to find this sea route to the Indies. His fourth and final voyage takes place between 1502 and 1504. And it's during this time that he sails along the coast of Central America, still not accepting or knowing that's where he was. He goes to Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. He's then shipwrecked in Jamaica before being rescued and returning to Spain. So this kind of story of shipwrecks as well is kind of a defining feature of these voyages that aren't often kind of like prominent parts of the story. So across his four expeditions, according to his own accounts, as well as the accounts of his enemies, he repeatedly tried to take advantage of the hospitality and curiosity he encountered amongst the indigenous Americans, tricking them into unfair exchange and forcing them to provide for him and his crew. And as the leader of the expedition, his actions set this example for his crew that legitimised and normalised violence against the indigenous peoples.
So by this point, as you've mentioned, there's a settlement, La Navidad on Hispaniola, which is the island today, is split between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. There have already been problems between the settlers and between the settlers and the indigenous peoples there. His children also played roles in the evolution of colonisation of the Americas. Can you tell us a little about his sort of family connections and how they were involved?
Yes. So Columbus's son, that's to his first wife, the Portuguese noblewoman, followed in his father's footsteps. He took up the title of the second Admiral of the Indies and sailed across the Atlantic, becoming the second Viceroy of the Indies and the third Governor of the Indies. And he spends much of his life, given the challenges that Columbus was also facing and these challenges to his rule, fighting to retain colonial titles and the revenue that they'd argued were hereditary, so should be going to Diego. He's surrounded by these interested parties that are actively interested in undermining the political and economic power of the Columbus family. In 1514, for example, Diego was recalled to Spain by Ferdinand of Aragon and was involved in many court cases regarding his revenue and titles. And these court cases, they're known as the Pleitos Colombinos, and they constitute a really large part of the colonial archive, because there's just so many disputes about these titles, what they could, what they indicated, what they were due. So he's kind of really ensnared in these kind of legal disputes, which are not just legal disputes, but also about the power of office in colonial period and so on. He's recalled to Spain, dealing with all of these challenges, but he, like Columbus, goes back and forth between Spain and the Americas multiple times. In 1520, he returns to Santo Domingo, but his fortunes didn't improve. He's beset not only by challenges by Spanish people who wanted to undermine his kind of claims to titles and colonial rule and so on, but also the active resistance of indigenous peoples. And he backs a quite famous enterprise that's worth mentioning, which is the enterprise of Bartolomé de las Casas in Cumaná, which is on the coast of today's northern Venezuela. And this was really successfully resisted by the local indigenous population, multiple different groups of indigenous people, which included the Cumancando. And Diego was blamed for the defeat of this settlement, in fact. So he's kind of successfully resisted by indigenous people. And something else worth mentioning about his estates is that he's also quite successfully resisted by an uprising of enslaved black people on his estate. So in 1521, the sugar plantation that's owned by Diego on Hispaniola becomes the site of the first known act of collective rebellion by enslaved black Africans. And I think that's significant to draw into the picture as well, because we often have the names of these people like Diego Colón, who we know is the son of Christopher Columbus, the names of the people involved in this first black insurrection in Santo Domingo, you know, are less familiar to us. And so it's a way to kind of draw them into the story, to think about their role in resistance and kind of causing these troubles for the heirs of Columbus. So Columbus has another son whose life is slightly less colourful, Fernando, and he seems to be the one that's led this life of more privilege and comfort compared to his older brother. He receives a formal education and an allowance from the revenue collected by the family. He did accompany his father on the last disastrous trip to the Americas, but apart from that, he stayed in Spain working on these lawsuits for the Columbus family.
So it's interesting, obviously, we're talking about colonies in the Americas, but at that time, Columbus believed that he was looking at Asia. What were those colonies called in Spain? How were they known to the colonizing powers at that time?
They were still described as the Indies, and they were being given names as the colonizers were going, effectively. And these were very Christian names often. So Santo Domingo, Saint Dominic, also kind of after the Spanish monarch. So Hispaniola, you know, being named after Isabella. So naming them specifically also after things that you would associate with the Christian religion.
So by the end of his life, he'd sort of unwittingly created the start of colonization of what we now call the Americas. Can you tell us how, where and when did Columbus die? And what did he think about his work at that time?
So he died in Valladolid in May 20th, 1506. And the cause of death can't be precisely known. Different people have debated it. But of course, our sense of medical knowledge and diseases has changed over time. And it was known that he was definitely in poor health. In fact, he'd been in poor health since the end of his first expedition in 1492. This is unsurprising given the poor nutrition and sanitation on board these early transatlantic ships. As you rightly say, he died never believing that a new continent had been found, and protesting that he'd been visiting these islands off the coast of Sipangu, Japan, near Cathay, and that he was on his way to these spice markets in the Indies. And it's for this reason, it's something we often don't reflect on, that the Americas is so called. It's not after Columbus, but in fact after another Italian, Amerigo Vespucci. And it was Amerigo Vespucci that really kind of realized, the first European to realize, we should say, that these lands were a new continent, in fact. And it's for this reason that Europeans called the new continents America and not after Christopher Columbus. Something else worth mentioning about the death of Columbus is that he traveled perhaps more in death than he did during his lifetime. And he was moved by this global geopolitical processes, which arguably his first voyage created. So his body was first laid to rest in a Franciscan habit, as I say, in the Franciscan monastery in Valladolid. It was later moved on the request of his son, Diego, to Seville, first to another monastery, and then on in about 1513, we think, to the cathedral. But it had always been Columbus's wish that his body be laid to rest in Santo Domingo on the island of Hispaniola. And in some time before 1540, we know that his body had arrived there and been laid to rest in this cathedral. The journey of Columbus's body doesn't end there. So in 1796, after the Spanish had ceded about two-thirds of Hispaniola to the French during the War of the Pyrenees, the Spanish reportedly removed Columbus's body from Santo Domingo to their fortified town of Havana in Cuba. Cuba gains its independence in 1898 during the Spanish-American War. And so it's at this point that the body is moved again from Cuba, which is getting its independence, back to the cathedral in Seville. Now, given how much the body moves, it's unsurprising that there's been lots of debate about where the true body of Columbus is. And despite the fact that it was meant to have been moved back to Spain in 1898, in 1877, during a renovation of the cathedral in Santo Domingo, which is where his body first was when it moved across the Atlantic, a priest discovered a box marked Remains of Christopher Columbus. And now, still today, this cathedral claims to have at least part of the relics of Columbus.
His story was almost as fascinating in death as was in life. And that's interesting because, of course, he crafted his own legacy in many ways. He wrote about his travels and he shaped the view of his life very much. Can you tell us anything about what he wrote and what he said about himself that shaped the way we see him and how he was seen at the time?
Yeah, so Columbus, you know, in popular imagination is often depicted as this courageous individual defying the dominant worldview of medieval Europe, which is often described as backwards. But in fact, Columbus was one competitor in what can be described as a very competitive medieval spice race. And he was, you know, part of this very active intellectual world that was taking influences from the Middle East, from sailors traveling in the South Atlantic, the North Atlantic. And yet, of course, he crafts his own legacy to depict himself as standing alone, making these claims, you know, against the kind of dominant worldview, as it were. And yet he's the kind of one who, until his death, is still protesting that the Americas don't exist and that he's on his way to China. I think what's significant about one dimension of the way he crafts his legacy is the way he gives it so much religious meaning later in life. So he also writes the Book of Prophecies. And this is a kind of really fascinating text where he kind of shows that this movement across the Atlantic was not just a movement in space, but also a movement in religious time, effectively. But this is towards the end of his life, and he's emphasizing this prophetic significance of this movement. And at this point, despite the fact that earlier in his career, he was really keen on showing the world how much of a brilliant scholar he was, even though he was self-taught and not noble and so on. At this point, he says that this is kind of a religiously inspired act. And there's a citation from the Book of Prophecies that I think really sums this up. He says, "For the voyage to the Indies, neither intelligence nor mathematics nor world maps were of any use to me. It was the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy." So we kind of, you know, is really emphasizing this point that traveling west was something that was revealed to him. And it's part of this kind of broader project of the need to regain the Holy Lands and so on. And he finished this passage by saying, "Whoever has as much faith as a grain of mustard will be obeyed by the mountains." And again, I think these passages are really important for that, highlighting that kind of specific worldview that he's part of and the role of religious ideas in shaping the way that this colonial project plays out as well.
So he had a view about what he'd done and how he wanted to be seen. What can we say now about what his greatest achievement was?
So the opening of the transatlantic world undoubtedly transformed the lives of people on both sides forever. So Europeans today could not imagine living in a world without indigenous American crops that we've become dependent on, from potatoes and tomatoes to chili and chocolate. But unfortunately, while people across Eurasia have often benefited from these connections with the Americas, indigenous Americans, their communities and their ways of life have often suffered. And I think given this colonial legacy, it's really hard to think about this European crossing of the Atlantic as an achievement. But it was certainly transformative, and Columbus certainly played a role in this. Paradoxically, perhaps, we can say that Columbus's biggest achievement is arguably his erroneous miscalculation of the Earth's circumference, because it's this underestimation of the size of the Earth and his lack of knowledge about the continents of North and South America that helped him successfully make the case to the Spanish monarchs that this Western voyage was feasible. Without Columbus, Europeans would have likely arrived in the Americas one way or the other. Fishermen were going further into the North Atlantic, pursuing ever-depleting cod stocks. There was Portuguese sailors going further south. And in fact, this voyage to the south along the coast of Africa leads the Portuguese eventually to land on the coast of Brazil. And so this encounter, this meeting of worlds is likely to have taken place at some point before the end of the 16th century. But what Columbus does with his miscalculation and his lobbying for the westerly voyage is to bring this contact to happen by the end of the 15th century.
So we've talked about those sort of geographical miscalculations and also the impact of landing and the way he treated indigenous peoples there. Could we say, slightly simplified, what was his biggest failing?
According to his own diaries of the voyage, when Columbus encountered the indigenous peoples of the America, he quickly began to take advantage of them and their lands economically and politically. And also this rhetorical construction of the indigenous people as exotic objects. And I would argue that this work that Columbus is doing, both in the Americas, but also how he's writing about this and communicating about the Americas and its peoples to a European audience, is what helps lay these cultural foundations for the discrimination and regimes of inequality that would come to define European imperialism. So Columbus had originally wanted to find a westerly ocean route to the Americas and to discover some islands along the way. Yet his first acts in the Americas were not those of trade or diplomacy, but to plant a flag and claim these lands for the Spanish crown, and also to capture its peoples and to send some of these back across the Atlantic to Spain. These actions weren't inevitable, and they weren't the only ones available to Columbus. And yet the die is cast through these actions in a way that will shape the lives of millions of Indigenous Americans, and also arguably the African peoples that are then brought to the Americas. And these actions arguably accelerated the trajectory of European imperialism in the Americas. And so in short, I think that Columbus's greatest failing was to not recognize the autonomy and integrity of the people whom he encountered in the Americas.
So having said all of that, and that there's a huge amount to cover here, I wonder if we can perhaps encapsulate briefly, what's Columbus's legacy today?
If anyone's been lucky enough to visit that beautiful city of Seville in Spain, they'll have undoubtedly seen the long queue of people waiting to enter the medieval cathedral, where you can visit the casket that is home to at least some of the remains of Columbus. And next to this casket, there's the main altar in this cathedral of Seville, which is gilded with gold from the Americas. Opposite the cathedral sits also the old imperial trade house and the archive of the Indies, which holds the documents relating to the Spanish Empire. But there's little really around there to reflect upon the broader story of colonialism that played out across the Americas from the moments its ships first arrived in those Taino lands in the Caribbean. So on the second Monday in October, people in the United States of America celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. And this federal holiday used to be known as Columbus Day, in celebration of Christopher Columbus. As early as 1977, the UN sponsored an international conference on discrimination against Indigenous peoples in the Americas that discussed the need to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, calling for a recognition for the people erased from history by colonialism rather than the celebration of the European who established the first colony. So Indigenous Peoples Day was first formally celebrated in 1992 and formally recognised by the US president in 2021. The pace of change is very slow, and there's still so much work to be done to understand Indigenous peoples, their ideas, values, and ways of life that have been marginalised by Europeans since the time of their first arrival in the invasion that took place in the Americas in 1492.
That was Julia McClure, senior lecturer in late medieval and early modern global history at the University of Glasgow.
Thanks for listening to today's Life of the Week. Be sure to join us again next time to learn about another fascinating figure from the past.